Every single time you buy a coffee or clock in for overtime or even just click accept on a new remote job offer, there is this invisible physics engine running in the background, and it is dictating exactly how much of your own wealth you actually get to keep.
Yeah, it really is like a massive multiplayer video game, right? There's the game you see on the screen, like the quests, the graphics.
Right, the stuff you interact with daily.
Exactly. But then there is that hidden code underneath. The code dictating gravity, speed, collision. And if you don't understand that underlying code, I mean, you are basically just mashing buttons and hoping for the best.
Hoping the IRS doesn't notice you mashing those buttons.
Yeah, pretty much. You might get lucky occasionally, but you are playing at a severe disadvantage compared to the people who have, you know, actually studied the mechanics.
Well, today we are hacking that engine. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are exploring a massively comprehensive guide called U.S. Tax Law 2026, which was published by the American newspaper and American TV. And our mission today, our whole goal, is to completely reframe how you think about taxes.
We really need to stop looking at tax as just a math problem.
Oh, or worse, like this annoying once-a-year chore where you just blindly fill out some forms and cross your fingers.
Yeah.
The tax code is literally the legal, economic, and administrative operating system running underneath every single transaction you make in your life.
And to establish this right at the top, understanding why the rules exist is the absolute shortcut to mastering them.
The cheat code, basically.
Right. The tax system isn't just trying to collect revenue to pave roads. It is a highly tuned behavioral incentive machine. It's designed to redistribute wealth, provide social insurance, and push you toward very specific actions.
Yeah.
Once you stop seeing it as just a punishment and start seeing it as a series of behavioral levers, the entire structure starts to make a lot more sense.
Now, a really quick reminder for you listening. This deep dive is strictly for educational purposes. We are looking at federal law based on our sources current through July 18th, 2026.
Right. Very important date.
Yeah. But we are just exploring the mechanics of the law. This is not professional tax advice. Always, always consult a professional for your specific situation.
Because your specific tax results turn entirely on your unique facts, the documentation you maintain, and, you know, the guidance that is just constantly evolving in the courts.
Speaking of the courts and the rules, if we want to actually use this operating system, we first have to understand who writes the code. And according to our source material, the power dynamic of tax law has fundamentally shifted recently.
It's been a massive earthquake in the tax world, honestly.
So let's look at the hierarchy of power. At the absolute top, totally untouchable, is the U.S. Constitution.
Right.
And below that, you have the actual statutes passed by Congress, the Internal Revenue Code, along with international treaties.
Which, historically, Congress writes in very broad stroke. They pass a law that says something like taxable income. But they do not want to get bogged down in the microscopic detail.
They don't have the time for that.
No, they don't. So they delegate the actual day-to-day rulemaking to the Treasury Department and the IRS, who then issue these massive volumes of Treasury regulations.
Okay, so regulations are below the statutes.
Yes. And below those regulations, you have binding judicial precedent from the courts. Then, further down the ladder, you have administrative guidance from the IRS. And finally, at the very bottom of the hierarchy, literally sitting in the basement, you have IRS forms, instructions, and publications.
Okay, wait, let's unpack this for a second, because I think most people, myself included until recently, treat an IRS publication, or like the FAQ section on their tax prep software, as absolute unquestionable gospel.
Oh, absolutely. Everyone does.
Right. Like, if the instruction manual on an official IRS form tells me to calculate a deduction a certain way and I follow it perfectly, you're saying that could actually be wrong.
You could absolutely be wrong.
And if I get audited, the judge won't care that I followed the IRS's own instructions.
It is one of the most dangerous misconceptions out there. What's fascinating here is that errors in an IRS publication do not bind the government. Think about that for a second.
Oh, wild.
The IRS can publish a pamphlet. You can follow it to the letter. But if that pamphlet contradicts the actual statute passed by Congress, you will lose in court.
So the instructions are just, what, suggestions?
Well, those forms and instructions are essential for actually filing your return, but they are not the law. They are just the IRS's summary of the law. You always, always have to trace your tax position back to the actual statute or the formal regulations.
That feels incredibly unbalanced.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like the referee, the courts just got a lot more power to check the IRS's homework. The guide spends a lot of time on the massive impact of the 2024 Loper-Bright Supreme Court decision.
Yes.
Why is this such a huge deal for a normal taxpayer?
Because it ended a decades-old practice called Chevron deference.
Chevron deference. Okay.
Right. For over 40 years, if a tax statute was ambiguous, and I mean, they almost always are, and the IRS wrote a regulation interpreting it, the courts would generally just shrug and defer to the IRS as long as the interpretation was, you know, somewhat reasonable.
So the IRS basically had a massive home field advantage.
Exactly. They were playing on their own turf with their own refs, but Loper-Bright destroyed that. Now, courts exercise independent statutory judgment. They do not automatically defer to the Treasury anymore.
So if you get audited this year and the IRS points to one of their own regulations to deny a deduction you took, you actually have a fighting chance to go to a judge and say, hey, the IRS made that rule up. It goes beyond what Congress actually wrote.
You do.
And the judge might actually agree with you.
Precisely the point. The courts are now aggressively interpreting these laws themselves without just taking the agency's word for it.
Okay, so if the courts are aggressively interpreting these laws, we really need to look at what exactly they are interpreting this year. Let's talk about how the sweeping July 2025 legislation actually hits a listener's paycheck in 2026.
Let's do it.
The source material outlines the basic individual tax architecture, and it all starts with gross income, which the law defines incredibly broadly as accessions to wealth. Basically, did you get richer?
From whatever source derived. That is the key phrase.
Wait, whatever source.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if you found a gold bar on the street or received a standard paycheck or got paid in some obscure cryptocurrency. Unless there is a highly specific law excluding it, it is gross income.
Okay, so you start with that massive bucket. Then you subtract specific exclusions to get your adjusted gross income, or AGI.
Right.
And then you subtract your standard deduction, which the guide notes is 16.1 for singles and 32.2 for joint filers in 2026 to get your final taxable income. We don't need to get bogged down in the math, but the top ordinary rate for 2026 is sitting at 37%.
Which is a significant chunk.
It is. But where this gets wild, where the physics engine really shows itself, are the temporary deductions introduced for 2025 through 2028. Our source details a qualified tips deduction up to $25,000 for specified occupations.
And there's also a qualified overtime deduction up to $12,500.
Which is huge for hourly workers.
It is, but we need to look at the mechanism of that overtime deduction. It doesn't just make all overtime hours tax-free across the board.
Oh, really?
No, it specifically targets the premium element, like the extra halftime pay that's required by the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Oh, wow. So it's incredibly surgical.
Very much so.
And it doesn't stop there. There's a passenger vehicle loan interest deduction up to $10,000. But get this. Only if the vehicle had its final assembly in the United States.
Right, highly specific.
Plus, a new $6,000 deduction specifically for seniors. Oh, and we're also seeing the newly authorized Trump account, Section 530A, which allows after-tax contributions with restrictions that generally lock the money up until age 18.
Yeah, and those specific accounts just started allowing contributions in July 2026, so we're watching the regulatory framework around them evolve in real time. But notice the structure there. You pay tax on the money before it goes in, but the growth is protected.
Acting as a lever to incentivize early savings for minors.
Exactly. Highly specific, locked-in savings.
See, here's where it gets really interesting. Look at the hyper-specificity of these new deductions. We aren't just talking about a flat, across-the-board reduction in income tax rates.
Not at all.
We are talking about deductions specifically targeting tips, or the exact premium half pay of overtime, or car loans, but only for U.S. assembled vehicles. Mm. This isn't just basic revenue collection. Are we using the tax code to micromanage behavioral economics on a massive scale?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it proves exactly what we established at the beginning. The government is using the code to directly incentivize certain types of labor, certain types of manufacturing, and specific savings habits. If they give a tax break on the premium portion of overtime, they are fundamentally altering the cost-benefit analysis for both the workers and the employers.
It changes the math of taking that extra shift.
Exactly. And regardless of the political origins of these laws, because we're just looking at them mechanically, here they function as invisible hands. They alter the physics of your financial life to encourage you to move in specific directions.
Okay, so that is how the levers work when you're an individual navigating your own paycheck.
Mm.
But what happens when you step out of the employee role and decide to build the machine yourself?
That changes everything.
If you decide to start a business, the specific entity you choose to form is going to entirely rewrite the physics engine of your taxation.
Mm-hmm.
It's like having to lock in your character class before the game even starts.
And unlike a game, you can't just easily swap classes mid-campaign without facing massive tax penalties.
Right, you're locked in.
You have to choose upfront. And the core divide you face is between pass-through taxation and double taxation.
Okay, so most people are probably familiar with pass-through entities. This includes your sole proprietorships, standard LLCs, and S-corporations.
Yeah.
The brilliant part of a pass-through is that the business itself doesn't pay any federal income tax.
All right.
If the business makes $100,000 in profit, that profit just passes through directly to the owner's personal tax returns. You only get taxed once.
Which is incredibly efficient, but as you can imagine, people constantly try to game this.
Of course they do.
Particularly with the S-corporation. An S-corp is still a pass-through, but it allows you to split your income. Part of your profit is treated as a W-2 salary, and the rest is treated as a business distribution.
Okay.
People love this because distributions aren't subject to self-employment payroll taxes, which are the taxes that cover Medicare and Social Security.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah.
So if I have an S-corp making $1 million, the obvious cheat code is just to pay myself a $1 salary, pay a few cents in payroll tax, and take $999,999 as a totally tax-free distribution right.
Nice try, but the IRS is way ahead of you on that one. That is the famous reasonable compensation trap.
Reasonable compensation.
Yes. You are legally required to pay yourself a reasonable W-2 wage for the actual labor you perform before you can take a single dime as a distribution.
So no $1 salaries for CEOs.
Exactly. If you try to pay yourself a wildly low salary for a high-level job just to dodge payroll taxes, the IRS will step in, reclassify your distributions as wages, and hit you with massive penalties. You simply cannot waive away the tax on your labor.
Okay, so pass-throughs have their rules. You can't just cheat the system. The alternative to a pass-through is a C corporation. And the guide notes, this is a completely separate taxable entity.
It operates in its own sphere.
Right. So the C-Corp pays a 21% entity-level tax on its profits. Then when it distributes whatever cash is left over to the shareholders as dividends, the shareholders get taxed again on their personal return.
Yep, the classic double tax.
And combined, this creates a federal tax burden near 40%. Wait, I'm stuck on this. So what does this all mean for a founder? Everyone online always says, just form an LLC to avoid the double tax. Why would anyone ever willingly choose a C-corporation if they get taxed twice? Forming a C-corp sounds like financial self-sabotage. There has to be a loophole.
There is a massive one. It's the ultimate exit strategy. The Qualified Small Business Stock Exemption, or QSBS, under Section 1202.
Okay, what is that?
This is the reality of venture capital. Yes, a defensible, well-documented C-Corp might face brutal double taxation on its operational profits. But tech startups don't usually have operational profits, right?
True, they burn cash.
Exactly. They reinvest every penny they make for years. They only care about the exit when they sell the company. And if your stock qualifies as QSBS, the sale of the company can be massively tax-free.
And the July 4, 2025 legislation aggressively updated these rules, didn't it?
It did. For stock acquired after July 4, 2025, there is a new tiered exclusion system. If you hold the stock for 3 years, 50% of your gain is excluded from tax. At 4 years, it's 75%.
Okay.
But hold it for 5 years, and 100% of your gain is completely tax-free. The new law also increased the per-issuer gain cap to $15 million and raised the gross asset threshold for the company to qualify to $75 million.
Hold on. Up to $15 million completely tax-free on an exit.
Completely tax-free.
That completely flips the math.
Ow.
I mean, if you are building a company that plans to sell in 5 years, you literally do not care about the double tax on operations because there are no operational distributions.
Right, you're not paying dividends.
You only care about shielding the massive payday at the very end. It proves that tax strategy is about modeling the end of the business, not just the beginning.
Exactly. You design your tax records at acquisition with the exit in mind. If you just casually form an LLC because some internet message board told you to avoid double taxation, you lock yourself out of that $15 million windfall entirely. The entity choice dictates the physical of the exit.
Wow. Okay, so we've optimized your entity,
mm-hmm.
but where you exist in the world is just as dangerous as how you operate. In 2026, geography is an absolute minefield.
Oh, it is arguably the single biggest trap for modern businesses and remote workers today. People fundamentally confuse where they form their company with where they actually owe taxes.
So let's start with individuals. The guide makes this massive distinction between domicile and statutory residency.
Two very different things.
Domicile is your permanent home. It's where your heart is, where you intend to return, where you keep your dog, your primary driver's license. But statutory residency, that sounds like just a cold mechanical math problem.
It absolutely is. The New York example in the guide illustrates the danger of this perfectly.
Walk me through it.
So imagine you are unequivocally domiciled in Tennessee. There is no state income tax. You love it there. That is your permanent home. But your company wants you in Manhattan frequently, so you maintain a small apartment there. And over the course of the year, you end up spending more than 183 days in New York for work.
Which is just a little over half the year.
Right. Just over half. Under statutory residency rules, New York does not care that your domicile is in Tennessee. Because you spent more than 183 days there and maintained an abode, congratulations, you are a statutory resident of New York.
Even with a Tennessee driver's license.
Doesn't matter. They can now tax your worldwide income based purely on your day count.
That is brutal. State tax nexus is less like crossing a physical border and more like a Bluetooth connection.
Yes.
You let one remote employee open their laptop in California, and suddenly your company has paired with the California Franchise Tax Board, and they start downloading your revenue.
That is a phenomenal way to visualize it. I'm going to steal that. And it's not just employees triggering that Bluetooth connection either. The guide highlights the Wayfair Supreme Court decision, which shifted the entire landscape for businesses.
Right, the economic nexus thing.
Yes. Physical presence is no longer required to trigger a state's sales tax. If you sell enough digital products or physical goods into a state, meaning you hit their specific economic nexus thresholds, you owe them sales tax, even if you or your employees have never once set foot inside their borders.
So the states are super aggressive. But what about international borders? Because digital nomadism is exploding right now. People are running whole businesses from laptops in Bali or Lisbon. Are they escaping this engine?
This raises an important question, but the answer is absolutely not. International borders are even more rigid. For non-citizens coming into the U.S., the government uses a substantial presence test.
How does that work?
It's a weighted formula over 3 years. So if you hit 183 weighted days, meaning they count all the days you were in the U.S. in the current year, plus a third of the days from last year.
Wait, a third of the days from last year?
Yes, and a sixth of the days from the year before that.
Wow, they really track it.
Oh, they do. And if that formula hits 183, you are taxed as a U.S. resident on your worldwide income. You accidentally stay a week too long, and suddenly the IRS wants a piece of the income you made in Europe.
That is terrifying. And what about the other way around? If you're an American citizen living abroad, you can't just hide your money in foreign banks, right?
Definitely not. You are subject to strict international reporting laws like FBAR and FASIA for any foreign accounts holding over $10,000. And the penalties for failing to file those forms can literally financially ruin you.
So what if you get so fed up with all this global tracking that you decide to just renounce your U.S. citizenship? Like, I'm out.
You run headfirst into the expatriation tax under Section 877A. The U.S. doesn't just let wealthy people pack up and leave. They impose a mark-to-market exit tax.
What does mark-to-market mean?
It means the government treats you as if you sold every single thing you own on the day before you leave. Your house, your stocks, your businesses. And they tax you on that imaginary profit before they let you hand in your passport.
That is wild. You haven't actually sold your house, but you have to pay tax on the profit you would have made if you did, just for the privilege of leaving the tax system.
Exactly. It's a massive toll booth at the exit.
What if we flip it completely? Say you have someone who never sets foot in the U.S. They aren't a citizen, but they just buy stock in an American company. Are they caught in this web too?
They are caught in a very specific, very dangerous cross-border estate tax trap.
Let's hear it.
So non-resident aliens generally do not pay U.S. gift tax if they gift U.S. corporate stock to someone while they are alive.
Okay, so far so good.
So they assume they are safe, but if they hold that exact same stock when they die, they do pay U.S. estate tax on it.
Wait, really?
Yes. The rules for living and dying in the tax code are completely disconnected. If foreign investors don't plan for both scenarios, their heirs end up paying a massive price. Legal formation in Delaware doesn't protect you from the tax footprint of your physical activities, your customers, or your mortality.
Well, that's a cheerful thought. Okay, so you've optimized your entity for the exit. You are obsessively tracking your day counts so you don't accidentally become a New York resident. You've modeled your global geography.
But you're doing everything right.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
But what happens when the IRS decides to audit your version of the operating system. We have to talk about controversy and the anti-abuse shield.
When the IRS knocks, the most fundamental boundary you have to understand is the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion.
Right. Let's be super clear on this. Tax avoidance is completely legal. It is the careful legal structuring of your affairs to minimize your tax burden.
Yes.
Taking that premium overtime deduction or forming a C-Corp for the startup exemption, that is tax avoidance. Tax evasion, on the other hand, is a felony. It's willful concealment, keeping double books, hiding cash under a mattress.
Exactly. But the guide points out that the IRS doesn't just look for outright evasion. They have very powerful anti-abuse doctrines to attack aggressive avoidance.
Like what?
The most prominent being substance over form and the economic substance doctrine under Section 7701 Mo. The courts will look at a transaction and ask a very simple question. Did this meaningfully change your economic position apart from just saving you tax?
So if I create this massive, complicated circular flow of money through five different shell companies just to generate a paper loss, but at the end of the day, I have the exact same amount of cash in my pocket as when I started TORT.
The IRS will collapse the whole thing.
Just like that.
Just like that. They do not care about the fancy labels you put on the contracts or how many high-priced lawyers signed off on the paperwork. They only care about the actual economic reality of what happened.
And if they do audit you, and they completely disagree with your return, the pathway of controversy gets very real, very fast. The guide says if you can't resolve it with the examiner, you receive a 90-day letter, officially known as a notice of deficiency.
This is a critical fork in the road. You have 90 days to decide which court you are going to fight the IRS in. You can go to the U.S. Tax Court, which is a prepayment forum. This means you do not have to pay the disputed tax before you fight them.
That sounds like the obvious choice.
It usually is, but there are no jury trials in tax court. It's just you and a specialized judge. If you want a jury of your peers, you have to go to the federal district court. But district court operates under the FLORA full payment rule.
Wait, let me make sure I understand this. The FLORA rule. If the IRS claims I owe $1 million and I strongly disagree with them and I want my day in district court with a jury, I have to literally write a check and pay the $1 million first and then sue the government to get my own money back.
I can confirm that brutal reality.
I'm joking.
Not at all. You must fully pay the assessed tax before the district court even has jurisdiction to hear your case. If you don't have the $1 million in cash lying around, you are locked out of district court entirely.
That is genuinely terrifying.
Which is why the tax court is so vital for the vast majority of taxpayers. It allows you to challenge the IRS without having to liquidate your life savings first. But it highlights a core tenet from our source material. Tax records are designed at acquisition, not reconstructed after sale.
Meaning you need the proof ready to go.
Exactly. When the IRS knocks, the burden of proof is almost always on you, the taxpayer, to prove your deductions. Imagine a guy trying to fake a mileage log, or invent a business purpose for a dinner, or reconstruct his exact geographic day counts 3 years after the fact during an audit.
He is already lost.
He's done. You must document the economic reality in the moment.
Man, we have covered a massive amount of ground today, going from the very top of the constitutional hierarchy all the way down to the brutal reality of handing over $1 million just to get into district court.
Mm-hmm.
To wrap this all up, U.S. tax law is a living, breathing blueprint of economic incentives. It really is the physics engine of the game.
It absolutely is.
By understanding the underlying code from how authorities are weighted to why you might leverage the double taxation of a C-Corp for a massive exit, to the invisible Bluetooth connections of State Nexus, you can actually navigate your financial life with intention rather than just anxiety.
Because knowledge of the system allows you to align your economic goals with the incentives the government is offering. You stop fighting the physics engine and you start building your strategies around it.
That's perfectly said. But I do want to leave you with a final forward-looking thought to mull over. Our guide notes that digital assets, like Bitcoin, are currently treated as property, not currency.
Right.
And we are seeing this explosive growth of decentralized finance, the massive expansion of the remote work gig economy, and digital nomads who can, you know, operate a Delaware corporation from a laptop in a different country every single month. These things are violently blurring the lines of physical borders and traditional employment.
They really are.
So the question is, will the 2026 geographic and structural tax frameworks we just discussed even survive the next decade? Or are we inevitably hurtling toward a completely borderless transaction-based tax reality that will require an entirely new physics engine to be built from the ground up. Think about that next time you log in to play the game.